Hello, Internet. Welcome to my first podcast. This is Yon. By popular request, I'm starting a weekly or pseudo-randomly timed podcast. We'll see which one it ends up being. So my first guest is Peter Eckersley from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm sure most people probably know what EFF is, but most of you may not know what Peter does. Peter's title is Technology Projects Director, is that right?
Actually, it recently changed to Chief Computer Scientist.
Right, Chief Computer Scientist.
Chief Mad Computer Scientist.
So what does that mean, Peter? Why did your title change?
But titles are just silly things that you have on your door. But what we do on our team is spend our time trying to prevent people from breaking the internet.
Huh. How does that happen? That sounds like quite a Herculean task.
Well, it turns out there's basically a comic book cast of supervillains who are regularly trying to concoct one scheme or another to undermine the safety, security, or just plain awesomeness of the net, and we have to figure out a way to stop them.
Okay, so it occurs to me that this is about the 2-year anniversary of Edward Snowden's leaks. What has working at EFF in that time been like?
Well, the Snowden leaks were strange for those of us who had been working on protecting people against surveillance for a number of years before those leaks started. If you were paying close attention before Edward Snowden's revelations, you probably suspected, many of us did, that most of the things that we learned about had actually been happening. But it was vague speculation, and it was amazing to get to peek behind the curtain and confirm, in most cases, in one or two cases, disconfirm that our predictions were correct. And I suppose, interestingly, in the last few weeks, we've actually had some new predictions that weren't in the Snowden leaks, that the NSA had basically been able to break a very large fraction of the crypto on the internet with an attack that's now being called Logjam. So that's, things continue to be very interesting. It continues to be hard to figure out what you can do to protect people against surveillance, but there are some important options, and we've been trying to make them happen.
Interesting. So I'm a little surprised at the certainty with which you said that NSA was using Logjam. Like, do you think that is a certainty, or do you think that's just a speculation?
It's certainly not a certainty.
Right.
It's merely a puzzle piece that looks like it might fit with the other bits of the jigsaw. The two things we know that there was a piece of reporting by James Bamford, who of course wrote a book about the NSA a few years back, where he cited a source inside the intelligence community basically saying that they'd had a giant breakthrough of some sort. They'd figured out how to do something that they hadn't been able to do beforehand, and that had made their lives very good all of a sudden. And an attack like Logjam, coupled with a lot of computing power, where perhaps they could use this attack to break the most common Diffie-Hellman handshakes that your computer uses when it does HTTPS connections or SSH connections or VPN connections, that could have been such an attack. And then the second clue was, in the Snowden leaks, there was a slide deck that implied quite strongly that the NSA was able to break most VPNs. And that was very weird and mysterious to us when we saw the slides. We couldn't tell how they would be able to break VPNs. Those are the missing pieces of the board for the puzzle. And then Logjam looks like it fits. Potentially. Certainly not certain.
Interesting. I guess I had an impression from that side you were referring to, that a lot of those breaks were just simply private key theft. So in your opinion, what do you think is the ratio of like real cryptographic breaks or real protocol breaks such as Logjam to just like simply stealing private keys or misissuing certificates?
So I think that there's always going to be a preference for anything that gets you passive traffic decryption. If you're a spy agency and you can just sit on the wire and figure out what people's communications are saying without having to interfere in any way with those communications, that's safer. Because if you change them, there's always a risk you're going to get caught. You could be caught by a project like the SSL Observatory. You could be caught by someone who just builds a little tripwire or something. Especially your most high value targets are the ones, perhaps some of them, who are also most likely to look closely for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit risky to use an active attack. Not that it wouldn't happen, and we know that man-in-the-middles do happen, and intelligence agencies use them, but this is really nice to be able to just sit on the wire, watch the packets go by, and then decrypt them later, which is what Logjam would let you do in many cases.
Do you think we might be overestimating the ability of server operators to detect active attacks? Because has there been a case where actually someone said, oh, I logged this server attack, which looks like an NSA thing. Does that happen? Certainly
Google has noticed a number of weird certificates. We believe they've noticed a number of weird certificates for their services via the pinning and reporting that Chrome does, which is essentially a larger scale version of the observatory. I would think that organizations that have a lot of expensive stuff to defend would be completely crazy if they didn't do any, at least in terms of certificate checking, man-in-the-middle protection. Now, yes, it's only going to be a tiny number of actors who will have these protections in place, but you can't use the methods with impunity.
Do you think there's anything we, by we I mean EFF or any other technology organization, can do to increase the probability that some random sysadmin would detect an attack like that?
So the answer is absolutely yes. It's possible to build systems that do detect such things. Years ago at EFF, we worked on a system which only ever really made it to alpha. We never got a production ready version of this, but it was a tool called Switzerland, which would tell you if the packets that you were exchanging with another computer on the internet were modified in any way, or spoofed in any way. And you can build a tool like that. You know, it turned out to be more work and more complicated than we expected because of the presence of NAT routers. And in a sense, Switzerland or something like it would need to run on your NAT routers rather than on your endpoints. But that sort of methodology is feasible, technically. Now, the other thing you can do, and this is something that obviously Google is doing, we are doing to some extent with the decentralized SSL observatory, is just look at the certificates, or maybe extend that, look at the TLS handshakes, and figure out from those, is this what I was expecting to see from this computer?
Right.
And there have been some reported instances of people noticing a related phenomenon, which is start TLS removal from email connections. There have been some documented cases of people detecting that. So we do get these man-in-the-middle attacks. They do happen, and people do occasionally spot them.
Got it. So switching topics a little bit, because I know you work on Let's Encrypt at EFF, and that's a major ongoing project. Can you talk a little about what Let's Encrypt is and the grand vision for it?
Yeah.
What do you want it to be?
So Let's Encrypt is an attempt to solve the problem of HTTPS not being easy to turn on. The reason the web is all HTTP by default when you make a new website and not HTTPS is that you need to get one of these certificates and install that in your server. If you've ever tried to do this, you would know that it's both somewhat expensive and extremely bureaucratic and time-consuming to figure out how to do it. When we took a smart programmer and asked them to enable HTTPS for the first time on their personal website, we started a stopwatch. We found that it took about an hour for them to figure out how to make HTTPS work. So this is a giant speed bump. that's interfering with the security of the internet, and we need to get it out of the way. So what we're going to do is we're actually in the middle of doing. We are launching a new certificate authority that will give you a certificate that lets you have an HTTPS website. It'll do that automatically and for free. So you can just run one command, and 20 seconds later, your web server is now speaking proper HTTPS that doesn't have a warning in a browser.
Cool. I'm sure many people have asked this question, but how are the other CAs okay with this?
So the certificate authority universe is very weird. It doesn't really obey logical rules. It's sort of almost an accident of history. It was a thing that was cobbled together by Netscape in the 1990s in a tremendous hurry because they needed a way to safely transmit, quote-unquote, safely transmit credit cards to online stores. And so they cobbled together this SSL thing, which has now become TLS and HTTPS. And they needed a way to identify sites, so they grabbed this standard that had existed in the 80s called X509, created these certificates, they bolted it onto SSL, and that's the Frankenstein's monster that we've been living with ever since.
Yeah, well, so lots of people ask the question, why don't we just make something better than the certificate authority model, like things like convergence and Namecoin and so forth? Why hasn't anything better or anything different come along?
The hard thing that you need to deal with, and this is actually the hard thing about all internet engineering at this point in history, is the incredible number of computers out there, literally billions of them, that have very old operating systems and won't get the update that does your new fancy thing that has better properties. So any solution to a security problem on the internet needs to be enormously backwards compatible with systems that were installed 10 or 15 or more years ago. Now, it's convenient in the case of the certificate authority system that there are so many certificate authorities. The fact that there are many of them undermines our security, arguably, because any one of them can sign an attack certificate against any website. But it's also convenient if you want to make a new, free, automated certificate authority. You can find any of the existing ones, and if you can find one that's willing to cross-sign you, then you get to be a CA.
Right.
Now, in theory, of course, actually, you could make your own CA from scratch. You could get into the Microsoft CA list, the Firefox CA list, the Apple CA list, etc. But you then have to, after you did that, you'd have to wait around for 10 years so that enough all of those old computers had been replaced with ones that knew to trust you before you could actually issue certificates and expect the whole internet to work with them.
Got it. So switching topics again, because EFF works on so many different projects across so many domains. So you started a project a few years ago called Privacy Badger, which was to block third-party tracking on the internet. One of the questions is, many companies like Yahoo, Google, etc. make most of their money through online advertising. Is there a way to do that in a way you consider privacy preserving?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started Privacy Badger because at the time, and this is still often the case, actually, it's a complicated question, but it's often the case that we can't, there's no other tool we can tell people to install that we think is going to protect them against online trackers without any further configuration. There are a lot of tools out there like Ghostery and Adblock Plus, which are widely used and which can protect you, but Ghostery, for instance, doesn't block any trackers when you install it. And so some fraction of Ghostery users are confused and think it's protecting them when it isn't. In the case of Adblock Plus, it focuses only on blocking visible ads. And you need to change the settings in order to make it also block invisible trackers in the pages you go to. Now, we wanted Privacy Badger to be the solution to that problem, a thing you could install and it would just do the right thing. But we also want it to be consistent. We don't want it to undermine the feasibility of using advertising as part of the way to fund creativity on the web. But what we do insist upon is that if the user hasn't given consent, the ads that they see can't record their reading habits and keep a record of everything they do online, every page they go to. So right now, almost all of the online advertising world insists on tracking people. When you see an ad, the ad sees you.
Yeah. It seems like one asymptotic conclusion is that everyone says, do not track me. And in that case, many advertisers wouldn't make any money because no one would be tracked.
Well, there are two parts of this. One is, you know, if you just want to show ads to people, you don't need to track them. Now, if they click on the ads and you have to start billing someone for the ad because it was clicked, you probably are going to need to do some level of tracking. But I think everyone in this debate kind of accepts that idea. If the user clicks on an ad willingly, then it's fine to record the fact that they clicked on it and what page they clicked on the ad on. But if the user doesn't click, there isn't really a reason why you need to track them. You just need to figure out a good way to show decent ads that doesn't depend on knowing everything about the user that you're showing the ad to. Now, Google, for instance, does a very good job of this with search because they're able to see what you're searching for right now. And so they have a way to know what's relevant to you. But you can also do it by just picking the right ads for the pages that the user is going to. If you're on a bicycle website, you can show them ads for bicycles and bicycle-related things that are culturally resonant with the pages that they're on. Or if the user is looking at cars online, you can show them ads for local car dealerships. Now, that's the baseline. Like, it's just instantly easy to do that. It may also be possible, from a technical perspective, to do a bit better. You may even be able to show people, if you really want to, ads that are actually quite intelligently targeted, but which don't necessarily mean that a record was kept anywhere off that user's computer of what they've been doing online. For example, you could, when the user goes to a website about cars and appears to be browsing possible cars to purchase, you could put a short-lived cookie on their machine that doesn't have a tracking identifier in it. It's not a unique cookie. It just says, hey, for the next day or two, show this user some car ads. Now, the funny thing about this is, there's one company actually that is starting to experiment with this sort of technology, and it's Mozilla. And the strange thing that you face if you're doing this kind of advertising is people get really mad at you because they don't understand that you've gone to great lengths to build a non-tracking targeted ad system. You're seeing these ads which look like they know a lot about you, but actually they've been carefully architected not to. And so I think if people want to do work in this space, as Mozilla is trying to do, they need to focus on how they can explain to the user, hey, this ad is selected off your own computer, or it's based on non-tracking data structures, but we're still showing you stuff that is related to your past activity.
Got it. And we are about out of time, arbitrarily chosen time limit. So thanks, Peter, for joining the first ever unnamed podcast.
It has been a pseudo-random pleasure.
Thank you.